Shrink Wrap Radio number 413, The Unification of Clinical Science and Psychotherapy, with Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita, author of 7 professional books on psychotherapy, 2013 American Psychological presidential candidate, who has also received many American Psychological Association awards and has served as the president of APA's Division 29, the Division of Psychotherapy. You can find out more about Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita by visiting our show notes for this episode on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here today, David.
Well, it's great to have you here. And Magnavita, it sounds like it might be Italian. Would that mean something like great life?
Exactly. And so far, I've been living up to this large expectation that I have a great life. So I'll keep you posted.
Yeah. What a wonderful name.
Thank you.
Well, you're actually off somewhere on vacation, but I've forgotten where you are right now.
Well, we have a home at Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and we're at our house at Cape Cod at the moment.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And you're a sailor, because I know you said you had to check the tide charts.
Yes. We enjoy sailing, and it's a very therapeutic endeavor for me. I have a very active clinical practice. I have had for 30 years now, and it's good to also get away and take care of yourself, as most clinicians know.
Yeah, that's an important reminder. Well, I'm glad to finally be able to speak with you. I believe I first reached out to you about a year ago, and at the time, you were running for president of the American Psychological Association. How did that turn out?
Yes. Well, I came in out of 5 candidates. I came in 5th, but it was a very interesting experience. I certainly learned a lot running for APA president. I learned a lot about myself, and it was a very interesting experience. At this time, I've decided not to run again. I have other interests that have been compelling me at the moment. So it was a fun learning experience, and I met a lot of very interesting people.
Yeah, I'll bet you did. And it was an ambitious thing to go for. And the American Psychological Association, I believe, is the largest professional association in the world. And if that's the case, there's no shame in coming in 5th.
Thank you. My narcissism was somewhat wounded, but I think I got over it.
Yeah. What was the platform that you ran on?
My platform really had to do with trying to bring in a more unified approach to psychology and clinical science and psychotherapy. I've been working for the last probably actively 10 years, but probably all my career has been leading me into the direction of looking at what we do in a more holistic and unified perspective.
Well, we're going to get into that in more depth in a bit. One thing that you said in your campaign was psychology needs to consider developing psych incubators. And I thought that was an interesting concept. What did you have in mind?
Well, what I had in mind for that is that we have to really encourage more creativity and more entrepreneurship. A story that I often tell is that when I was first in clinical practice many years ago, I was one of 2 psychologists in my section of Connecticut. And I left working in a hospital, which I enjoyed very much. I worked in a private psychiatric hospital that's no longer in operation. Managed care seemed to drive them out of business, as many other hospitals. It was a very good hospital, very forward-thinking, and was based on a systemic approach. We did a lot of family therapy, did a lot of systems work. And I worked there. I did my clinical internship there, and then I worked there for 3 years. But I found that in a hospital setting, at a certain point, in order to be able to advance, you have to kind of give up doing clinical work, which was my passion, and to go into administration, which I did not really want to do. So I opened an office, and I had an idea of doing a practice that was based on a team model. And even though we all take that for granted right now, it wasn't very common 30 years ago. There were a lot of people who were pretty much solo and very independent and did not really work together effectively as a team across disciplines and across approaches. So I had an idea to open a team-oriented practice and jumped into that and started a practice, which became successful pretty quickly. And I remember having a postdoctoral fellow working with me, and we were out getting coffee one day. And this person said to me, you know, there's this other psychologist in town who said that you're an entrepreneur. And I recall at the time being flushed with shame. Oh my God, I'm an entrepreneur. Because it was actually a very, it was kind of a demeaning thing to say at that time in that zeitgeist, because if you were considered to be an entrepreneur, you weren't considered to be in it for the right reasons. And yeah. So what I've learned over my career is, as psychologists and as mental health clinicians in general, we've learned very little about how to be entrepreneurs. And I mean that broadly. I don't mean just in how to make money, which I think is important, because I think if you can't support your family, it's very hard to be a clinician who's there for the patients that you're working with. But what I mean by entrepreneurs is really being innovative and creative. And getting back to your question, so when I thought about developing psych incubators, my idea was that there would be a mechanism, an online place for people to go who had innovative ideas, who wanted to meet other people who would be willing to work on these ventures, and maybe actually have some venture capitalists who would be available to fund some of these projects. I think psychology has not been really great at inviting the best and the brightest lately, because unfortunately the best and the brightest seem to want to go to Wall Street and make enormous buckets of money. So I think we've lost some of our clinical soul and passion, and I think it's really important to get that back by encouraging creativity, innovative ideas, entrepreneurship, and putting what we know to work and what we don't know by learning things in other disciplines in a way that really forwards our field.
Yeah, the term psych incubators, that concept kind of caught my eye, because I think we share an interest in technology, and
yes.
in the area where I live, there are, you know, I'm not that far from Silicon Valley, and so the idea of incubators for technology, software development, and so on is one that I'm familiar with. Also, in the platform that I saw online, you suggested that psychology needs to embrace the challenges of big data. And that's something I've been reading about with my market research hat that I wear. They're talking about big data.
Yes.
What were you getting at there?
Well, I think that I totally agree with you about technology. And I think psychology really needs to be on the cutting edge of technology, which I've been very interested in a couple of the projects that I worked on. One, and I'll get back to your question in a minute, but one is the Unified Psychotherapy Project and Psychotherapeutia, which are combining technology in a way, hopefully, to advance the field. But I totally lost track, I'm sorry, of what your original question was, and getting off my musing. So just state that question again.
Yeah, it was about you in your platform, you suggested that psychology needs to embrace the challenges of big data.
Oh, yeah. Big data. That's right. Yeah. These things are also connected in my head. I can get lost in talking about this.
I fully understand.
You know, big data is really an area that we need to be familiar with and take advantage of, because we're now amassing such large amounts of data through the internet in terms of patterns of behavior that are going to inform just about everything we do. And I think for behavioral and mental health to be able to access data sets that we've never before imagined is really a phenomenal opportunity. For the most part, most practitioners are what we consider local clinical scientists. We have a number of people that we work with over time. We gather some data about what works and doesn't work, and we read some literature, we read some research, and we try to use that in order to refine and to perfect what we do. With big data now, we can imagine, for example, patients coming into our office, filling out some brief symptom checklist and other psychometric instruments, having that information being logged in some large database, and we can amass data that will really give us ideas about what makes and helps people change, what are effective change agents, how people change, and what we can do to facilitate that. It's really an area that I would encourage young psychologists to consider getting trained in, because I think getting trained in decision analytics, which is based on big, large data sets, is really going to change the world in ways that I don't think we can conceptualize right now. In fact, there was a book that I just read about big data that used an example of an epidemic of a some kind of virus that the CDC was very concerned about and tracking, and some Google scientists were able to, by tracking the key words that people were using in their online communications, like when they were asking for what kind of medication should I take for these symptoms, they were able to predict how this this epidemic was unfolding before the CDC could do. And it's really phenomenal. Yeah. So I think we're really just beginning to get into the era of big data. And again, really what that means is that everything we do on the internet emerges as patterns. And these patterns can be tracked in ways that we could never do before because of computer capacity that we have now that we never had before. So this is going to change the world. And I really think it's going to change behavioral and mental health and clinical science and psychology.
Well, an idea popped into my head as you're speaking here, that it does have a darker side, as we know from recent disclosures about the NSA, and also certainly the world of marketing has become very expert at using online social data to track our tastes and interests and so, and relationships and so on. But what really just now popped to mind was that Facebook is accused of having conducted a large experiment having to do with emotions. And I don't know the details of that, but in a way that I almost wonder if some psychologist was involved. I could understand that.
There was a psychologist involved in that gathering of that data. And I think that, you know, the ethical question there is, was the data gathered without informed consent? But again, what technology and advances in biotech is doing, and psychotech in a way is pushing the parameters of ethics to a point where it's hard to keep up with these ethical questions. And that's a whole other area of interest that I think is very exciting. Like, yes, what does that mean? And you bring up an incredibly important issue, David, in terms of, yes, how is this going to be used? And is this going to be used in helpful ways, or is this going to be used in ways that have a really dark side? And I think the answer is both. I think this technology and these advances will be used in ways that probably are pretty dark, and hopefully more likely and more importantly, they'll be used in ways that serve society. But I think it's going to be a tension that we have to deal with as we proceed, because the ground rules aren't written. And, we just are expanding in so many areas that are affecting clinical practice and research that we just don't have the answers for yet. Like just the question of doing telepsychology, how are you really allowed to treat someone who you've never met in person? And are you allowed to treat them if you don't have a license in the state where you're treating them? All kinds of issues are just blowing up for us right now that we need to have smart, knowledgeable, well-grounded people be able to systematically address.
Yeah, I agree with you on all of that. And it sounds like you have more knowledge about this Facebook emotion experiment than I do. And I know it's a bit of a digression from where I plan to go, but hey, I'm going to grab the opportunity while it's here. What can you tell us about that?
Well, as I understand it, what they were doing is they were testing out how they could affect people's emotion by embedding some data with a control group. And I don't remember exactly what they were embedding, but I think they were embedding something negative to see how that affected the emotion of the response of the user. So it really was direct psychological research, and it was manipulating the Facebook users in a way that that does raise some interesting questions. Now, the interesting part is they found that that they could actually affect Facebook users' emotional state by embedding certain items into the Facebook experience, which is that's the interesting part. The scary part that you talked about, the dark side, is that people weren't aware that they were being subjects, and that goes against everything that we think is ethical about experimental design and research, that people need to have informed consent.
Although there are a lot of social psychology studies that where I guess they're more observational in a way, but they will expose people to two different sets of circumstances and then be able to draw some conclusions. Mm-hmm. I can really understand the temptation that psychologist would have to say, oh my goodness, here's a way that I can, you know, get a massive amount of data to demonstrate this. I wonder if that psychologist is going to be called to account, or if there are going to be forums or symposia within the APA to discuss the issues raised by that particular incident. Do you know?
Yes, I'm not sure. I don't have any direct knowledge of that, but I would imagine that whatever organizations or societies that the scientist works with might want to investigate that, but I don't really have enough information to know one way or the other what they should be doing. I just really read about this in the popular literature, so I don't know what the behind the scenes story is. But you know, again, getting back to your point, David, it does suggest this slippery slope that can go down to very dark places. When you talk about being able to manipulate people's emotional state, who are unaware of that their emotional state is being manipulated using Facebook, it is pretty. It's already sliding, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not surprising that it had an impact, because I just did an interview with Dr. Thelma Lobel, an Israeli social psychologist, and some of her research covered things like if a person is given a cup of hot coffee or hot chocolate and they're holding it in their hand, they're more likely to make favorable decisions. And she gave an example from her own life where she was selling a piece of real estate and she was given a hot beverage, and she felt in retrospect that she gave in much too easily on the negotiation over price. But she had a lot of, you know, going beyond that personal anecdote, she had a whole lot of controlled research supporting that sort of phenomenon.
Well, we're another area that we're advancing in is neuroscience, and we're learning more about how our limbic systems resonate with other people's limbic systems, mm-hmm. and so much of what we pick up about who is safe and who is not safe and who is friendly and who is not friendly really happens at the level of the limbic system perception, and mm-hmm. And there's so much that we don't know about it. We're beginning to crack this conundrum a little bit, but so much of what is communicated is not done verbally. It's done through other senses and other processes maybe we're not even aware of in terms of limbic system resonance.
Yes, yeah, and that was the point of her research, was that there are all these sensory modalities, each of the sensory modalities, were impacted in our decision-making and our evaluations unconsciously. We're not aware that it's happening.
Well, we're incredibly biased. In fact, you're just getting into another area of interest that I've gotten into in the last 2 years. I just finished a manuscript, an edited volume that is on clinical decision-making that APA will be publishing hopefully next year. But the manuscript is complete now and in process now. And what really compelled me in this area, and it's what you're talking about, how we make decisions and how biased our decision-making is, because so much of how we make decisions is done through non-conscious processes. So I think that's probably what your interviewee was talking about.
That yes.
We're very biased. We have two different decision-making main decision-making modes that we operate out of. One is fast and one is slow. And wow, we can get ourselves in really messy situations if we're not attentive to what the influences are in how our decisions are derived.
Right, right. Okay, getting back to the main flow of our conversation here. This has really been interesting, though. One of the things that you're known for, and I think that you alluded to earlier, is your work with what you call the Unified Psychotherapy Project. So what can you tell us about that initiative? What does that mean, the Unified Psychotherapy Project?
Well, once you get me talking about this, David, we're going to need another interview. But the Unified Psychotherapy Project is a project that I started with a couple of colleagues about almost 10 years ago. Steven Sobelman, who is my partner in this, and Jack Anchin, our other partner, comes out of a belief that psychotherapy is now reaching a point where we're leaving the stage of integration. So let me tell you a little bit about that, and not to bore you with this too much, but you know, psychotherapy, clinical science, which psychotherapy is under, is a pretty new endeavor and science, if I want to use that in parentheses. So we started out with single domain or single school approaches of therapy. We had psychodynamic and behavioral originally. And then we moved into existential, humanistic, other forms of psychotherapy, such as cognitive. So for the first part of our history of clinical science, we had these different domains that were almost like, if you want to think about it, almost like different tribes with different languages, different rituals. If you went to a psychoanalytic conference, you would see, you know, lots of people with beards and pretty formal and maybe kind of stayed in the way they held their conferences, and they would read their papers. And then if you went to you know, cognitive therapy or behavioral therapy one, you'd hear a lot about research and science. And so there were these different schools of therapy, and they had their different languages, different sort of emphasis on research or clinical phenomena. And what happened in 1950 was Miller and Dollard wrote this book where they translated, it was a classic book in the field, where they translated psychoanalytic principles into behavioral terms.
Sure, I remember that.
Which really showed us that we're talking about the same phenomena, but we're using different language.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a kind of a breakthrough. That was a kind of a breakthrough book that sort of shook the field up. And then after that, I think what happened was there was a nascent movement to people investigating what other people were doing. And this, I think, culminated in the 1980s when a number of well-known pioneers, Paul Wachtel, Marvin Goldfried, Barry Wolf, and a few other significant people decided, hey, we got to start talking amongst ourselves. Paul Wachtel was a psychoanalytically trained family systems guy. Marvin Goldfried was a behavioral guy. So we got to start talking. And so they developed this wonderful organization called the Society for the Exploration and Integration of Psychotherapy, which is called goes by CEPI, which is still in business and a very active organization that still holds yearly conferences. Mm-hmm. So in the 1980s, we saw the beginning of the psychotherapy integration movement, and so that has been a very fertile movement that has moved us forward. But what I think we saw is that people began to smush schools of therapy together. Like you'd have cognitive behavioral, you'd have cognitive psychoanalytic. So people were trying to combine different theoretical aspects, different methods, different techniques to try to create better amalgams of therapy. So the Unified Psychotherapy Project emerged out of this really wonderful, rich stew of all these psychotherapies, which, you know, now we have about, I think, 400 different brands of psychotherapy.
Wow.
The point is that most approaches to psychotherapy use the same general principles and often a lot of the same methods. So the Unified Psychotherapy Project came out of my interest in saying and belief in that, you know, we're pretty much all going in the same direction here. Let's figure out what the guiding principles, processes, and methods and techniques that we all use are. There are a lot of similarities. If you watch any of the major psychotherapists who have videotapes on, if you watch their videotape, I'm often impressed by the fact that if you didn't know that Aaron Beck was doing cognitive therapy, you would think he was doing a more integrative approach. So if you watch any of the major therapists, the pioneers who have a lot of experience, their approaches seem to actually converge at some point.
Yes, I remember some research actually from some time back that kind of emphasizes that point, where they found that people, the therapists, talked very different games, but when you actually observed what they were doing,
exactly,
there was more similarity, yes, than there was divergence.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a few days watching clinical tapes at a conference on trauma in Bethesda, Maryland, a couple weeks ago, and I was impressed with you know, the differences, but the similarities in the way people work. And so, the Unified Psychotherapy Project emerges from some theoretical work that I've done over the years in trying to come up with a framework with which to organize all the methods and techniques of psychotherapy and clinical science. And that's what we call Psychotherapedia, which is our online compendium of all the methods and techniques of psychotherapy. What we're trying to do is organize them into a system that makes sense. And if people go to our site, you can see that we have four domain levels. And basically, it has to do with techniques that focus on the mind and the brain, techniques that focus on and methods that focus on dyadic relationships, interpersonal relationships, what happens between two people. And then we go to a larger network, what happens in triadic relationships. And then beyond that, how these all interact between the individual personality system, the family system, and the social, cultural, and political system. So it's basically a systemic model. It derives a lot from Yuri Bronfenbrenner's work, who uses nested structures like Russian dolls, where our mind and brain are located in our attachments, in our dyadic processes, in our family structures, and in our larger social economic structure. So it's a total look. It's a breakdown of the biopsychosocial sphere into four levels. And when you look at therapy through these lenses, you can look at various methods and see how people work. And some people have favorite domains that they work in. But I think it's important for people to have an overall perspective and know when they're stuck in a certain domain and when they have to move out. Or in a sense, if you think about going from a microscopic look, like we're looking at maybe what's happening at an anxiety defense affect level inside someone's experience internally, and then you move your lens out and you widen the lens to look at how they're relating to their husband, wife, boss, kids, so forth, or widening the lens even more, how are they interacting with peers and classmates and other people, and then you look at larger systems. So we're all operating out of in a large relational matrix, and I think that's the point, that we're relational by our nature, and that's how we're formed. That's how our personalities are formed, and that's how we operate. So this Unified Psychotherapy Project is a massive undertaking to try to really get the contours of what we're working with and elaborate them in some sort of framework that allows researchers and clinicians to move the field forward.
Well, that sounds really fascinating and very timely. Now, this Psychotherapedia database that you referred to, is that available to the public or just to researchers?
No, you can look up. That's online now. We had some problems. We're in the second iteration of it. We had some problems with scammers who got into our system, and it was down for a while. But we just have the new iteration of it up. And if you go to the Unified Psychotherapy Project's website, there are a couple of features of it. One is we have some videos of different approaches that we're offering, so you can see how different people work. We also have a link to Psychotherapedia, which will be the compendium which we're going to be working on getting people to help us catalog the techniques and then organize them under methods and place them in the system. So, you know, the vision would be that if you go to Psychotherapedia and you're interested in, say, a cognitive restructuring as a method, you could click on cognitive restructuring as a method, and then underneath that, all the techniques of cognitive restructuring would pop up, and then you could click on the specific technique of, challenging a irrational belief, for example, mm-hmm. and you would get a definition of that. You get references to that, where it comes from, and then you would get some patient therapist dialogue that would show you how it actually works. And what our grand idea and scheme is eventually to have some video clips, so you could actually see a patient therapist video clip showing you how that particular technique works. And then, you know, what could happen then once we have this whole compendium outlined, and there are probably only, maybe there are 2,000 techniques of psychotherapy, or maybe 3,000. Once you have them all cataloged and you watch how people click on, then you can start to use big data to develop algorithms. So if someone goes in and they have a 24-year-old clinically depressed, unmarried female who just immigrated from Bosnia or something like that, you could actually maybe track the click-ons for that, and then you could start to get some data analytics going there and see what, you know, how people put together techniques, how the techniques are put together in sequences that help people change.
Well, this is a very ambitious project, I must say, and it sounds like it's still we're still sort of midstream with it in terms of its development.
Well, I think we're more early stream because it's such an ambitious project that this is something that will be going on for hopefully years as it builds. So we're still very early stage in it, and you know, I don't want to mislead people to think we have this developed. It's a massive undertaking, and I often think of it as like the our equivalent of the genome project.
Yeah.
Where you know you really have to have a lot of data in there to make this as useful as it can be, but you know eventually we'll get it populated and someone will take it over after I'm gone, and it'll expand, and it will be something that in the future I think will be a great resource for clinical science. But we don't have that now. There's no place where you can go as a clinician or researcher and see the compendium of all the techniques that we've developed in our first over 100 years of evolution.
That's fascinating. And I like your metaphor of looking at different levels of magnification, mm-hmm. because there are different levels of, as a system.
Yes, different domains.
That are appropriate to look at.
So, and I think we kind of tend to get settled into a domain that we feel comfortable with, either through our training or through because of what our personal predilections are and our personality. So some of us might move more toward intrapsychic because we're more interested in individual process. Some might move more towards dyadic if we're interested in couples, and some triadic if we're interested in families, and some more ecosystem if we're interested in larger bodies. But I think the important point is that it's really important to have at least knowledge of the other ones, if not training, because change is not always done in the way we think. And I think our theories are maps, useful maps, but sometimes they only take us so far, so we need to be flexible in moving around the system.
What do you see as the role or the impact of recent advances in neuroscience for psychotherapy? Isn't that sort of aiding this convergence that you're talking about?
Absolutely. There are two answers I have that to your question. One is that there is a lot of neuroscientism going on, which I think is always a danger when something exciting emerges, that everybody wants to talk about things in neuroscientific terms. It reminds me of what happened earlier in my career when brief therapy was beginning to emerge, and everybody began to turn their approaches into brief therapeutic approaches by putting brief therapy in front of the name of their approach. So there's a lot of neuroscientism that is not well-founded that goes on in our field, and also a lot of it's being offered to the public. But I think some of that's really, have to look at with a skeptical eye and view. But neuroscience, I think, will really and is advancing our field in ways that we cannot imagine. And I often think that our future offices are going to be somewhat different than we imagine now. I think that in the future, when you come into a psychotherapist office, you're going to potentially sit in a chair that has you wired in a way that's unobtrusive to monitors that will be able to give you and your therapist immediate biological feedback on your processes. So as we are engaging in the therapeutic process, there will be a monitor maybe over the back of the patient's seat and maybe one over the therapist's seat, so we can read what's happening as we go. For example, wouldn't it be great when you're working with someone who has a trauma background that you could notice how their galvanic skin response changes, how their heart rate variability changes, how their neurofeedback changes as you're beginning to do some trauma work with them, focused trauma work, and beginning to help them to metabolize the experiences that have not been able to metabolize before. So, I mean, that's, I think, a way that some young innovator is going to develop that's going to be on the market at some point, where you have a psychotherapy chair and that uses the computer technology that we have to give you instant feedback. So you know specifically when you're getting a client to the point where they're getting over aroused and they're beginning to dissociate and they can't make use of what you're doing anymore, and they can get the feedback themselves and actually watch that on a screen.
Yeah.
We do that to some degree now, but I don't think we do it systematically.
Yeah, I know people who were reaching for that 30 years ago, involved in biofeedback.
Yes.
and now neuropsychotherapy. But it's not standard currently, and not everybody's trained in it. And also the unobtrusive connections haven't been available. But I agree with you that those are coming.
Yes. I mean, just the technology and the neuroscience are going to interact, I think you sort of mentioned this, in ways that I just think are going to be so exciting, David. One of the symposium that I got to watch when I was at this trauma conference is a good friend of mine has been doing some pioneering work in having video monitors running when he's doing therapy, and actually having a video monitor that the patient can watch while they're doing therapy. And it was really fascinating, because what was happening was there was a whole nother level of dyadic process involved in the session, and that was the relationship between the patient and herself as she was doing the therapy, she mm-hmm. was actually being watching her own facial response to what she was saying, and she was beginning to be able to identify and develop compassion with herself in a way that was just remarkable.
Wow. Who is that psychologist friend of yours?
It's a psychiatrist. His name is Michael Alpert, and you should definitely do one of these interviews with him because he's a fabulous guy doing some interesting work and very humble, but very interesting work that I was watching. We did a 2-day seminar together where we were training some people from Europe in psychotherapy, and so we were looking at a lot of psychotherapy tapes, and it's fabulous what you do with just affective restructuring, just monitoring the affective response in a very close way with patients can just open doors that you can't imagine. So there are so many roads to Rome, and I'm always suspect of anyone who says they have the way to get there with anyone, because there are different roads, and people require different roads to get where they want in terms of the kind of change they're after.
Yeah. What's that last name, Alpert, A-L-P-E-R-T?
Yes.
Okay. And so has the medical model outlived its usefulness?
Oh, you're asking me such interesting questions. I would say at times yes and at times no. I still think there is a place for the medical model. I think all the models that we have, I think of as metaphors, and they can be useful metaphors for people who change, who are trying to change, and they can be toxic metaphors depending on who you use them with. Let me give you an example. Another good friend of mine who's a psychiatrist who I worked with. I just wrote a chapter about our collaborative work in my new book on decision making. We collaborated very closely over a 3-year period on trying to give people the best psychopharmacological and psychotherapeutic approaches in a package with the two of us. And one of the metaphors that he used that I liked, and it is a medical model metaphor, that's why I'm going to share it with you. He would often have people who would come in, and because he was a psychiatrist and specialized in psychopharm, people would come to him because they wanted medication. So, but he was also very sophisticated about and well trained in psychotherapy. Just he wasn't really practicing psychotherapy at this point, but he knew a lot about it and saw its value and usefulness. So people would come in with some sort of distress, some kind of symptom constellations, that we see anxiety or depression or whatever. And he would say, after he met with them for a while, he'd say, this medication that I'm going to give you is going to be really helpful, but it's really like the medication is putting a cast on a broken leg. And in order for that broken leg to heal, you really need to see my associate, Dr. Magnavita, who does psychotherapy, because the healing comes with learning and developing and growing and letting that that cast hold you while you're doing the work, which can be painful. And I love that, but that's a medical model metaphor. So I don't think the medical model is antiquated, because medication and medical approaches are sometimes really useful, and that model is really critical for some people. There are still people who have refractory clinical depressions who will respond to ECTs. That's certainly a medical model. There are lots of medications that are useful. Sometimes assuming a role of being sick is useful for people. And I think the point is that we don't want to ever apply any model, whether it's a medical model or whether it's an emotional or learning model, to a person that it doesn't provide value for. So any metaphor or any model we use needs to be done with consideration and deliberation of how can this be useful to the person in healing.
I know there's been a big push from APA for evidence-based psychotherapies, and I'd kind of like to sound you out on that. I've spoken to others in these interviews about evidence-based psychotherapy, and I've heard mixed reactions. On the one hand, pretty much everyone agrees that it's laudable to have evidence for the efficacy of a particular approach. And on the other hand, there are concerns that the subtleties of some approaches may not lend themselves well to a manualized type of analysis. And they also raise the issue of the high cost of mounting, for example, double-blind type studies, which typically only big pharma has the money to do these days. And that sort of research is hardly in their own interest. To research non-pharmaceutical approaches to psychotherapy. So what are some of your thoughts in relation to this?
First of all, let me say that, David, that is a beautifully articulated question. Obviously, you're well informed about this. And the other thing before I try to answer it as best I can is that I must disclose that I am at this point until the end of the year serving as the vice chair of the Clinical Treatment Guidelines Advisory Committee. In fact, I just got off a phone call with the group before this interview. And so I'm very familiar with the development of guidelines. And I think there is a dialectic here that we can't dismiss. And I think you beautifully highlighted the dialectic that on one side, clinical phenomena is very complicated, does not always lend itself to an RCT, randomly controlled treatment study approach. But on the other side, the way science advances is we need to be able to investigate things using the best of science. So I think if we begin to think about, excuse me a second. One second, can I stop this and get rid of this dog?
Yeah.
I am so sorry.
That's okay. Your partner was objecting.
Yes, I was hoping she was going to sleep the whole time, but we have people working on our house, and when people come, she goes a little bonkers.
Okay.
So getting back to the question of the dialectic between – can you hear that in the background, or are we okay?
I can hear it, but I don't think it's too distracting.
I'm sorry. I apologize to the listener. If there's ever going to be any of this with the listeners, I apologize. But we're getting back to the dialectic between the science and the clinical phenomena. That there is going to be this dialectic. And as a full-time clinician, I certainly feel like I straddle that world of understanding what it's like to be in clinical practice. I think at this point in my life, I've probably logged in about 35,000, I think, 45-minute sessions of psychotherapy over my career. So I've been doing this for the last three decades full-time. So it's been my mainstay. So I'm very aware of how messy clinical work is and how difficult it is to fit into research paradigms. So I totally understand how clinicians are suspicious of this. On the other side of the coin, I think in order to advance the field, clinicians need the best evidence available to make decisions. And I think the development of treatment, clinical practice guidelines will really offer clinicians, the public, and policymakers knowledge about what, at this point, what the best evidence we have is. And there are so many parts of what we do that we have no or little evidence. We don't know a lot about what the harm is of different therapies. We used to think that psychotherapy didn't harm anybody. We know that's not true, that sometimes in the hands of therapists who you might say or at the bottom quartile, according to Michael Lambert's excellent research, some of these therapists will actually do harm. They create iatrogenic difficulties. So there's a lot we don't know about harm. There's a lot we don't know about a lot of things. I think we must put money into research. I don't think psychotherapy will be funded. I don't think it will be paid for by third parties if we don't prove efficacy. So I think this is a train that's left the station in terms of evidence base. I think for people who are not familiar with clinical practice guidelines, What I think would be useful to do is take a look at the NICE guidelines, which the UK has been doing for probably the last 10 years, NICE guidelines. If you just plug that in, you'll see how the UK has developed guidelines. They're very informative, very important, and they're great resources. So, again, I think it's a dialectic. I think that you have to be able to hold both positions in your mind at the same time and not go crazy with mm-hmm. them. That yes, there's a lot that the evidence base is not going to help you with, is not going to even talk to, but there is some veracity to the position that, you know, if something doesn't work or does harm, we probably shouldn't be doing it. Like, we probably shouldn't be doing regression therapy. We probably shouldn't be doing debriefing therapy. Maybe we probably shouldn't be doing crystal therapy because, you know, the results aren't all that robust, or maybe sometimes they cause harm. Or we shouldn't be doing therapy that helps people change their sexual orientation. So research is one part of what helps us guide our clinical practice, but it really has to be done in the context of informed clinical decision making and clinical expertise and patient preferences.
Well, I really appreciate your very informed and balanced response to that issue. Now, you mentioned that you've done something around 35,000 session hours. I have to assume that there's something about being a therapist and working with people in that way that that you find rewarding and gratifying. What can you tell us about that?
I have a big smile on my face right now. This is a lovely question. So another story I'd like to share with you that from this conference that I just got back from, which was just wonderful because everyone showed videotapes of their work. And while I did not always agree with people's approaches, just to have people show the video of what they do is such a wonderful experience. And I encourage all therapists to video their sessions and get a group and look at them because you'll learn so much by watching yourself and other people work. But my friend Michael Alpert, who we just talked about a minute ago, showed this session, which I thought was just a lovely session of working with this woman who just had a lot of trauma in her past and was really coming along in the work that he was doing with her. And after the presentation, another colleague and friend got up and in front of the group said, "Michael, one of the things that I want to say about watching your tape that just came through to me is that you enjoy what you're doing so much. It was clear that you're having fun." And I thought, yes, I mean, that's really important. Now, I don't want to mislead people to think that it's always fun, because sometimes it's the most distressing and challenging and taxing work that one can do. But it is such a privilege and a blessing to be able to share that kind of intimacy with people, to have them come to me with their problems and their hopes and desires and ask for my guidance in helping them walk a path with them to having a more fulfilling life. And I still can't think of any better career. It's been a real pleasure being able to do this work for so many years. I think that when you love what you do, people just resonate with that and they get it. And mm-hmm. when you try to improve what you do by videotaping and by expanding and continuous improvement and educating yourself and learning, I think it's a great model for people because continuous improvement is really what I think we should all strive for. I'm still a student of this after all these years. I think I have established some expertise, but I'm a student. I learn from watching other people work immensely. I learn from talking to people like you. I mean, it's what really makes this such a great profession and field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, burnout is a phenomenon that many psychotherapists struggle with. How do you keep from burning out, and what's your advice to others in this regard?
That's another really important question. So one of the things that I do is I'm here at my other house where I get to work on an old sailboat, which I find therapeutic. I like to restore old sailboats, and I like to sail, and I like to keep physically fit and active, and I like to have a eat well, and I like to have a good supportive social network. I think that the important thing about doing clinical work is that we, as caretakers, can lose sight of taking care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think to find that balance is so important, because there's the need out there is way beyond what any of us could ever satisfy. And so I think you have to have reasonable boundaries. You have to know, you know, when you need to take care of yourself. You have to know when there are cases that you need help with or you need to refer. I think you probably should have your own psychotherapy, which I think helps take care of you. And I think you if you stop really enjoying for the most part what you do, then I think you should do a self-assessment and say, well, okay, what's going on here? Because I think burnout is about not feeding yourself. And maybe for some people, it might be being in the wrong profession. For some people, it might be not a good match to do this kind of work, to sit there all day long and to listen to people suffering. It's not for everyone.
Right, right. I remember bright-eyed students who I think often are imagining themselves in a situation where you know, where they're receiving lots of gratitude and recognition, you know, from the people that they're working with, and maybe not realizing the hard work of it and the fact that you are sitting all day long with people who are unhappy.
In distress and suffering, and sometimes have been horrifically traumatized and have never talked about it and need to talk about it, and you need to be able to bear that. So a couple of things that I think about is I think it's important to be aware of vicarious traumatization, which is a hazard. And what I mean by that is most people that we work with at some point have probably had a trauma history. So it's very painful to listen to people's stories about trauma. It can vicariously traumatize us. I think you need a way to clear that for yourself. You need to find a therapist or a support group where you can help clear it out of your own neural networks. Otherwise, it can get stuck there and you can be losing sleep and having PTSD symptoms yourself. So I think that's important. And I think, you know, if you're not growing and developing and evolving and you're starting to dread going to work, then I think you need to do a self check and see what's going on.
Yeah, so a related question then is, I know that at least some of my listeners are students in training, and so what's your advice for how a person might best become a really good psychotherapist?
That's a thought-provoking question. I think I would encourage new psychotherapists to try to keep open to other perspectives and alternatives. I know that as a young psychotherapist, when you're feeling really insecure and inadequate, and not that I don't feel that now, I still feel that now at times, insecure and inadequate when I work with something that challenges me or pushes me beyond my threshold. Mm-hmm. But when you're young in the field, you're often looking for an approach that's going to give you directions, like a cookbook,
yes,
of methods and techniques. And while I think that's important to learn, I also think it's important to try to keep an open mind to other ways of looking at things and other approaches. And now that can become overwhelming because there's so much to learn and we never stop learning it. There's no stopping because it just keeps going. It's such a rich and diversified profession. So I think as you're beginning to learn approaches to psychotherapy, I think what I would encourage is get a videotape, get a camera. They're very inexpensive, and get a consent form and start videotaping yourself. My best learning, I think, has been in videotaping my sessions and watching them with a peer group or getting supervised. Because you might think you're doing one thing and you might tell your supervisor you're doing one thing, but when you show video clips of what you're doing, it's a common experience that you can really learn from. So I would encourage people to get comfortable, or maybe not get comfortable, but accept the discomfort of videotaping yourself. Even if you just watch it yourself, as early as you can, get videotape. Video is like the microscope in biology. It opened up windows of research that were not available before videotape was developed. And now it's such an inexpensive microscope. You can get a videotape player for, you know, a good one for probably less than $200, and you can put it in your office and have a high quality video, and you've got the capacity to do clinical research with that.
Well, I think that's a really good place for us to close, and clearly your dog agrees and is applauding what you just said.
I apologize for my
No need. So, Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed this, and I look forward to listening to future interviews. You do a great job here.
It's easy to imagine that Dr. Magnavita is an excellent therapist. I left the interview with a smile on my face, due in no small part to the frequent affirmations he offered on the excellence of my questions. In fact, he used that very same phrase, "I have a smile on my face," in response to one of my questions. Not only did that give my brain a corresponding shot of joy juice, but it also suggests to me that he's good at being mindful of what's happening in his own body, and also being able to put words to it and to share it. And that sort of communication is great modeling for the client in a therapy session. I felt we had great rapport partly because of this reinforcement, but also because I could feel our mutual engagement and agreement about the topics we were discussing. Also, I must add, it also feels great to talk to someone at his level in the APA and to get the feedback that I'm really tuned into and understand the big issues facing psychology today. I do sense that myself. But it doesn't hurt to get outside recognition from someone who's so intimately involved with policy setting for APA. I was especially impressed by his ability to refrain from polarizing on some of the very controversial issues I broached, such as whether the medical model is no longer relevant, as well as the divisive issue of the potential usefulness or uselessness of insisting on evidence-based psychotherapy research. He said something to the effect that it's important to be able to hold the tension of remaining open to the issues on both sides. I doubt that he's a Jungian per se, but that struck me as a particularly Jungian insight that we need to be able to tolerate the tension of the opposites. I also very much liked his advice to aspiring therapists about the importance of getting therapy, supervision, and having the courage to videotape one's therapy sessions. I think that does require a lot of courage, whether shared with a supervisor or a peer group, or even just with oneself. And I resonated with his observation that new therapists have a tendency to want to glom on to a particular approach. I've seen that myself over the years. It's difficult to stay in that anxious place of uncertainty, and so there is a tendency to seize upon and cling to one therapeutic school or another. Finally, I have to say I'm in awe of his courage in taking on the gargantuan task he has set for himself, namely the creation of a unified overview of the entire psychotherapeutic enterprise. No small task that, but one extremely well-suited to our time.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Jacinda Duke in Wellington, New Zealand, and I just made my second donation this week, and it feels good. And so all of you listeners out there who haven't put your hand in your pocket yet, I strongly encourage you to, so we can continue to enjoy this wonderful service that's been provided. Keep it up. Love it. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Jacinda. I do hope others will be inspired by your action, and I want to thank all those others of you who have chosen to take action and to support Shrink Wrap Radio by clicking on that big multicolored support button in our right-hand sidebar. We now have a much fancier version of the transcript for Shrink Wrap Radio number 324, Exploring Heart Math with Rollin McCready. This is thanks to Matthew Dollitz, founder and editor of The Neuropsychotherapist, who has redone the transcript for inclusion in his online journal. You can get the transcript on our site, however, by going to number 324 on the transcripts page or going to the actual interview on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. As some of you have noticed, if you go to Shrink Wrap Radio on iTunes or you use a podcatcher app, you may have seen that you were only able to get the most recent 75 episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio. Well, I've increased the size of our feed such that iTunes will now show the most recent 125 episodes. Interestingly, our own Shrink Wrap Radio app is actually showing the most recent 204 episodes. I'm not sure how to account for that discrepancy, but it does give added motivation for you to download our custom app, which is available for both iOS and Android devices. Just go to the Apps tab on our site for full details. Speaking of the feed, I'm sure you've heard me talk about how much time it takes to put each of these episodes together and get them out to you. Sometimes it takes a long time because of some mistake I've made, and then the time it takes me to figure out where the problem is. The most recent instance of this was on episode 411 on mindfulness and resilience with Linda Graham. I had put the show up and thought everything was fine, but then heard from a listener that they weren't getting the audio. After 2 hours of troubleshooting, I finally figured out that the problem was I had put a hyphen in the name of the MP3 file. It's little things like that that drive you nuts. And that's not necessarily the diagnosis that I would give as a professional psychologist. One of my guilty pleasures is crime fiction. I can't recall if I've mentioned this here before or not. I probably have. Ever since The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson, I've been hooked on the Scandinavian crime genre, sometimes referred to as Nordic noir. I love that. Not only did I see the whole film trilogy twice, the Swedish version and then the American version. Actually, I've probably seen the Swedish version at least twice. And of course, I also listened to the whole trilogy on Audible.com. I'm not sure I would have plowed through these three long books by visually reading them, you know, physically. The physical act of reading is getting more challenging for me these days, but listening to a book read by a great reader really puts it in your mind in such a way that sometimes I can't remember which books I've physically read and which ones I've listened to. As you know, I've been promoting our new sponsor, Audible.com, and I think most of you are probably already members of Audible.com. But if you're not already an audiobook listener with a subscription to Audible.com, then why not give it a try by taking advantage of their offer of one free audiobook of your choice from their library of more than 150,000 titles. And I've been a subscriber for the past 10 years or more, and have always got one going. Of course, they have a lot of psychology content, but how about checking out The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, whether it's your first time or a repeat? If you're not a current Audible subscriber, that could be your free audiobook. So to get your free audiobook with no obligation to continue, go to audibletrial.com/shrink. And finally, as I said last time, I'm always trying to grow our reach, our listenership. And you can help by letting your family and friends and sundry others know about Shrink Wrap Radio, also by retweeting the tweets that I put out on and re-Facebooking, if that's possible, and re-Google Plusing, because I put announcements on all those. And if you've got a podcast of your own or a blog, please consider using me as an interview subject. I'll be happy to accommodate, and it'll be a win-win for both of us.
Hi, this is UCLA psychiatry professor Dr. Gary Small, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, noted UCLA psychiatrist Dr. Gary Small, who was my guest on the show a couple of times in the past. Now let's dip into some recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from longtime listener and supporter, naturopath Dr. Ralph Wood Wilson, who writes, in part, "David, what a treat it has been for me. Your latest podcast with Linda Graham was so clear that I've put a link to it on my latest blog about psychotherapy. The blog is part of my site, www.dcnn.pro. I'm sharing some of the text of my introduction to your podcast that I included in a possible closure of sessions with a couple who have been seeing me for a couple of months now. They may be ready to graduate and move forward on their own. He says, I've told them that I'd like for them to visit your internet site and listen to the Linda Graham talk about how therapy is being made much more straightforward. As I say in my blog, we can now think of psychotherapy as offering what I have termed pressing the human reset button. Once that reset button has been pressed, then the real work begins of helping the person guide what I call the trajectory of their life onward after this reset experience. I'm looking forward to enjoying Shrink Wrap Radio as a companion during my travels through the years ahead. We are all still learning, even from our mistakes and failures. Keep up the great work." And once again, that's from Dr. Ralph Wood Wilson, naturopath and a diplomate in acupuncture, among many other approaches that he is continually studying. And Dr. Ralph, let me respond that I am really grateful for all the support and feedback that you've given me over the years. The next one comes from longtime listener and past guest, Dr. James Alexander in Australia, who writes about the donation issue. "Good day, Dave. Great newsletter. My guess is that you have already thought about it, but in case you haven't, what about making access to all Shrink Wrap Radio programs available to members at a cost of, say, $10 per month? And in order to get people in, allow a visitor to access 5 sessions for free. Then they'll be hooked. Most listeners would be happy to pay $10 a month, which is a fairly minimal fee for what is offered. I think many regular listeners who are not donating probably intend to get around to it, but often don't seem to. Like I said, I suspect you have already thought of this and perhaps had it suggested in the past, and there may be either practical or ideological reasons why not, but just an idea." And that's best wishes from James in Australia. And James, yes, this is something that I think about from time to time. Some of the reasons for not doing it, in fact, are practical, wondering how in the world I would set it up at this point, and how I would restrict access, and how I would track the people who had paid, and so on. And some of it is ideological. I've made it available to the world for so long, for free. And at the same time, everybody has heard me making my pitch here to get somewhat more of a financial reward for all the time that I'm putting into it. So how about you, listeners? What do you think of James's idea? Would you encourage me to go down that path or not? I'd love to hear from people on that. I've thought sometimes maybe I should post it on the poll, but I never seem to hear from a whole lot of people on the poll either. So it's definitely something that's in the back of my mind, and I might make that move at some point, and I'm going to take James's suggestion as a vote in that direction. So with that, I think I'd better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, And you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our relatively new message phone at 415-830-4014. And you can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app that I mentioned earlier, and you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. So thanks again to Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita for an exciting conversation and his visionary efforts to accelerate the unification of psychotherapy. And once again, I'm not sure who my next guest will be. In fact, I don't have anyone lined up at the moment, and once again, I might just take a week off. I've threatened that before and haven't done it. I've hardly ever done that in the past 9 years, and I know everybody else seems to be taking vacations. If I do skip next week, you can always go to my list of the best of Shrink Wrap Radio and catch one you missed or revisit one of your favorites. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.